Welcome to Rebel Health Radio, bringing the best in alternative and integrative medicine to your ears.
Hi everyone, it's Patricia Wolby. Alchemy Therapy is my emotional audit and all the other things I'm involved with. And today, part two of my microdosing experiment, but I'm also going to generalize a bit more on some of the things I've been reading while I've been doing my microdosing. So one of the benefits of microdosing, which if you don't know what that is, I refer to one of my previous videos, but it's basically taking very small amounts of psychedelically active compounds, and in this case, psilocybin. And I reported last week that not terribly much had happened in my first week, really. Maybe the odd very distinctive dream, which has continued into week two. But something did happen. Well, several things happened this week, which I was really aware of. One was Sunday afternoon, where I took my microdosing slightly later. I took it at lunchtime instead of breakfast because, quite honestly, I forgot to take it. I take two little supplement pills a day when I'm on my 4 days on. And this is my fourth day of my second week. And I was out walking. I was shopping, that's right. And we were in a very, very dispiriting shopping mall. Well, it's not even a mall. It's an outdoor space with shops around it where I live. And I really felt the dispiriting nature of it very strongly, you know, that this was a soulless place. It's been recently redeveloped to make it safer, apparently, but they took away all the features of interest, like the trees and raised beds, and they replaced it with flat concrete. It was, yeah, to get rid of all the drinking and the alcohol, drug taking and so on in the area. So, but they've made it worse for the majority of people, and it's just a dust bowl now. Quite honestly, you know, litter and leaves, and you just walk in and think, oh, this is grim. So I was really aware of that for a start, and it really went deep. And the other thing was that the sun came out very briefly and some blue sky, and I'm in the UK, we've had a very, very wet autumn and early winter. And in fact, we've hardly had blue sky. I believe that's about to change. We're about to go into a sunnier, drier period, but we've had rain virtually every day, and the ground is absolutely saturated, and the skies have been so grey, which has been, yeah, a bit dispiriting, a bit depressing. And suddenly the sun came out and I was looking up at the clouds, as you do, and seeing the blue and the way the clouds move across the blue. And I was suddenly transported up, if you like, into that blueness. That's the only way I can describe it. I didn't levitate or anything, but it was like my imagination took me up into the blue. And I stood there for quite a moment. And my partner said to me, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Oh, just noticing the blue sky," because it was just really apparent to me how deeply that goes in when I see blue sky, and how much it lifts me. And I've always known that, but I was really made much more aware of it. And so that was something I noticed. The other thing was that, the dreams continued. And the previous week I had a really beautiful dream, you know, a dream of connection, of love, of longing, perhaps. This week it was a long-term friend of mine, and but meeting her and realizing she was going to let me down. She was not going to fulfill a promise to me. And that was really, really traumatic. And I ended up in the dream actually shaking her, which is awful. I mean, I wouldn't do that in reality, but just saying, "How dare you? You know, you said you would do this thing and you're not going to do this thing. And that's it for me. You know, I'm done," kind of. It was very dramatic and very angry. It just shows you what's within me, doesn't it? And how, again, we tend to repress a lot of the emotions that we feel if they're unacceptable to us. And certainly I do. I'm the kind of person who very rarely gets angry with other people. But when I do, I will express it. But I'm not very good at I guess, expressing it generally. And so it comes out in my dreams, I guess. So that's kind of been interesting and a different, I think, to the experience I had with Ibogo, which was much more a physical experience. This is definitely building into something else. And it made me think about meaning, and it made me sort of focus on watching videos that kind of develop that understanding. And something popped up recently, which was to do with what they called, the kind of the crisis in our environment, in our world at the moment, the psychological drivers of the crisis we're in. I think they called it the meta crisis, because it's a crisis in so many different areas. And I will pop the video that I watched, because it's very long. It's 3 hours, folks. Mine isn't going to be that long, I promise you. It's going to be a subtle account of the first hour, because I had to divide it up into chunks, because there's no way I can watch a whole 3 hours without moving. That's just not healthy. And it's three people that I, or two of whom I didn't know, and one of whom I did. And the one I did know is Ian McGilchrist, because I have his book. I have his book, The Master and the Emissary. This is a classic in the genre. It isn't his latest book. He's got others now, but it's the one I first heard about. And I found this in a secondhand bookshop, so I was really pleased. It's a really dense book, very tiny type, as you can see. So it takes a long time to go through. And the first half of the book is detailing his theory about the left and the right hemispheres and how they interact with the world and why they're very, very different. And the second half of the book is how that's impacted culture. And he takes you right through from ancient history to modern times, because we are, make no doubt about it, we're a very left hemisphere driven society, all right? And the result of that is an existential crisis, not just in terms of our health and our well-being, but in terms of how we are. We're the first species that can literally cause extinction, mass extinction. And we seem to be hell-bent on doing that. That's where we're headed. And of course, it's creating a lot of fear and a lot of depression. And so I wanted to watch this and see what these three learned men, the other two were John Vervaeke, I don't know how he says his name, and Daniel Schmachtenberger, neither of whom I'd heard of, but three very learned men, they generally are men. These discussions I've seen so many, particularly with Jordan Peterson. I tended to watch a lot of his, and he'll have like 11 or 12 people in a room, and they're generally male. I think I've seen one woman in the whole grouping, and that's just the way it goes, because we tend to regard men as more learned, and they tend to rise up the hierarchy, and so tend to get asked. And we're all biased, aren't we, in terms of who we regard as important, and we'll tend to match to what we understand, and so we tend to choose people much like ourselves. But anyway, that's an aside and not meant to be a rant, but it is an observation, because women do bring something very different to the table. But the first hour then was talking really about the crisis that we're facing. And in Ian's view, this is to do with the right hemisphere being subsumed to the left. And that's what he means by the master and the emissary. So, and he described how he came up with that title, and that it was a sort of mythic allegory of the master should be the right hemisphere, the hemisphere of the bigger picture, of intuition, of the global, of the whole, of the holistic even. And the left hemisphere, which is focused on getting, attaining, and detail, and the small kind of constituents of life, the bits, if you like, the map of the world rather than its wholeness. There should be the emissary, but in fact, that's been switched around in our culture since, he maintains, the Renaissance, that we are now in a culture that sees the world in terms of parts, sees the world in terms of gathering things and accomplishments rather than being part of something bigger. And so the left brain culture that we're in has brought us to the edge of extinction. What are we going to do about that? Well, he's talking about changing our mode of attention. Okay, so what we look at determines what we see. And, you know, my whole body of work, the books I've written, the work I do with clients is about changing the quality of their attention. Because for a lot of people that I work with, this isn't just an existential crisis. This becomes a physical illness. I've seen more and more that, you know, these kind of chronic conditions that people are turning up with, anxiety, depression, chronic pain, chronic fatigue, are crises of meaning in their lives. And their body just is a readout of that pattern that they are kind of creating, of feeling disconnected, of lacking connection and purpose and a sense of rightness. I know that's not a technical term, but, you know, a sense of rightness in their world. Something has gone awry. And that's what happened to me, of course. And so that's why I'm so passionate about this. And I had a revelation actually last night. So that's interesting. It's another, just an awareness of when I got ill. It was a crisis of belonging for me. I'd never put it in those terms before. I remember being really miserable. My relationship had broken down. I'd had to move from my home. I'd lost my pets. You know, I'd had to leave them behind. I'd gone into a bedsit, which, if you're watching from not in the UK, that means you rent a room in someone else's house, where I wasn't really wanted, to be fair. You know, I was there to help pay the rent, I guess, for the owner. And I was confined to my room. You know, I had a room. I was able to use the kitchen and the bathroom, but I wasn't allowed in the living room. That was kind of closed off for me. So it was like I didn't belong there. And this was meant to be a short stopgap, but it turned out that I stayed there a few months, and then I found another alternative. But it still was a very, very difficult time in my life, because the people I ended up living with, and I lived in several different places, didn't feel like home to me. They felt like stopgap places that I had to be because I didn't have any alternative. And I didn't feel I was welcome. And when you don't feel welcome, you don't feel like you belong. And if you've grown up with that feeling in your past, it's familiar and it has echoes in your body, and it builds and builds and builds. And what it says to you is there's no point being here. It fills you with despair. It fills you with a sense of brokenness. And then your body starts to read that out, okay? Because there's something going on, and it's usually hidden to you because it's not left brain. This is right brain stuff, if I dare say that, because I know Ian would come down like a ton of bricks on me for saying that's, you know, there's no such thing as only a left brain or a right brain aspect, that we're connected. The two halves are connected. But just to simplify things, I think to feel not part of a whole is where we're going down this route. And in fact, a recent survey, and this came out in the talk, a recent survey in 2019 in the UK showed an amazing, I think 80% of people feel lonely, feel hopeless. The sense of, we even have a ministry of loneliness, apparently. I didn't know that. It takes an American to tell me. But I guess it's part of a bigger ministry. It probably is a ministry of, I don't know, social affairs and loneliness or something. Please correct me if any of you know. But yeah, so we have recognized that loneliness is a really big factor, and so many more people are living alone, or they're living in situations where they don't feel they belong. They've lost contact with friends, family, church, you know, some meaning, purpose beyond themselves. You know, we're living in a much more secular society, and they talked about that a lot as being one of the drivers as well, because whatever you call it, loss of God, you know, some people think that's a good thing because it's sort of like it was superstitious, it was power driven. I make the distinction between spiritual and religious. For me, that it's the loss of the spiritual connection, the bigger purpose. And on Saturday, actually, I went to a local church here, which is over 400 years old, has a great deal of history, It's just literally down the road from me for a Christmas concert. It wasn't a religious service. It was a Christmas concert with human voice and instruments. And the acoustics in the church are gorgeous because it has a beautiful vaulted ceiling. And it's just a very special place. So much history there. And you can really feel it in the atmosphere. And then when the voices soar and you're listening and you're in harmony and a group connection with other people, you feel suddenly, I belong. And I didn't know most of the people, but I knew a few. We met a few people there who we did know and had a conversation with, and it was including a neighbour and some ex-counsellor and a few other people. And it was like, yeah, I'm part of a community. I'm part of something that matters. And so these things mean finding meaning is not just about purpose. It's not just about having something that you must do. You could say I find meaning in my work, and that's what I did for a while, you know, in my 20s and 30s. And, you know, I was very driven to achieve. I wanted to become a research scientist, which I did. But it never really gave me what I expected. It didn't give me that deeper sense of meaning. It just was something I went in and did every day. And some days I would think, oh, this is really good. I'm making a difference. But a lot of the time it fell short because it didn't have that soulful connection. And so meaning and purpose are not the same thing, although meaning is need, you need purpose for meaning. Okay. So it is sufficient, but it's not, it's required, but it's not sufficient. So you need to have purpose in order to have meaning, but it's not enough to provide meaning. Meaning is something much, much greater. It's transcending your individual, isolated, atomic self, you know, me as an individual person with no connection. And it's sort of allowing you to make a broader connection of feeling and belonging to something. So I think it's really important to understand that we are, as human creatures, we are dependent on the quality of our interactions with others. And without that, we feel a deep sense of disconnect from our environment, from nature, from ourselves. And this, I believe, is one of the reasons we end up anxious and depressed. Now, there was a lot of discussion on the difference between anxiety and depression in their discussion, which I won't go on into here because there was a source of disagreement between two of them about why it's different and why they're, you know, one believes they're two sides of the same coin and anxiety is a more global representation. And Ian was keen to disabuse us of that notion and say that they're both whole brain issues, but in different combinations. So I don't know about that. I'm not a neuroscientist. I do know that there are aspects of the prefrontal cortex that get involved that can't quieten down the anxiety. You know, I've written a book about parts of that called The Scar That Won't Heal. That's available, which, you know, goes into detail on the neuroscience as far as I could find it out. But my experience of people who are suffering anxiety and depression is that the body is involved too, all right? And that is completely missing. You see these three men sitting in an Oxford beautifully paneled wood room, and you look at their posture as well. And I think, yes, they're coming at this from the head, from the neck up, as always. And their bodies are very static and well, middle-aged, let's say, and I'm not going to criticize that because I'm middle-aged too. But, you know, I think we have to talk about the body's involvement, and the wholeness of the human experience can't just exist here. And we can't just align ourselves with our thinking, because that's part of the issue. And getting into feeling states which exist in the body was entirely missing so far. I haven't watched the whole discussion, as I say, I'm just talking about the first hour, entirely missing from their discussion. And I've done another video on why I believe anxiety isn't just a brain state, you know, that it has feedback from the body. Obviously, it begins in an awareness of threat, but the threat may come from sensory impressions that are felt in the skin or the gut or or any other part of your body that remembers things that were dangerous for it and signals to the brain. So it can be bottom up rather than top down. And of course, it's about everything, not, you know, it's not all about the body and it's not all about the brain. I've got to be very careful there not to, in my need to perhaps broaden the discussion, make it sound like I have the answer, because I don't. But my awareness when I'm working with people is that they often have implicit memory stored here in the body of threat, which triggers anxiety, which the brain then tries to decode and work out. And so that can be something that can be addressed through various ways of connecting somatically with the body, whether it's Heidening or tapping or eye movements in EMDR. So it's a very interesting experiment that I'm involved with, and I am trying to come more into my body and less in my head and more into my right hemisphere, if you like, than my left. And that seems to be what psychedelics do therapeutically, is they kind of break the stranglehold of the left hemisphere. And it feels to me anyway that they dissolve the kind of critical overthinking state and allow you access to a bigger picture awareness. And that's certainly what happened to me when I was kind of transported into the blue, which was really weird and really beautiful, actually. People who take high dose psychedelics find that, and it could be overwhelming, actually, because you do become the color. I watched other videos this week where people were, there was this lovely woman who'd never done anything in her life. She was a church going, very conservative person, and she was asked to take part in a psychedelic study. And it had to be someone who had never tried it before. That was part of the setup. And she said, it wasn't that I became aware of the colors. She says, I was the colors. Now, I find that really exciting, really interesting. And it totally changes your worldview. It changed hers. And that's what seems to happen with these kind of therapies. Now, obviously, what I'm doing is not the same. I want to be very careful in making that distinction. Doing a therapeutic high dose is very, very different. You have to really take into account set and setting there. You have to be in a place where you are held, connected, safe. And much of the problem that we saw with psychedelics in the 60s was that people took them randomly in combination and sometimes in situations with other people who were tripping and therefore not safe. And, you know, conversations with people that lived through that time tell me that, you know, it really affected them in a negative way. And it has been something that has been very difficult for them. Brian Wilson springs to mind. You know, I watched a film with him. He's the Beach Boys' main composer and musical director, and he's still with us. And, you know, he's 81 now, but, you know, he went through some really hard times with LSD because he already had kind of a very open awareness. That's what enabled him to compose these things in his head. He composed the whole of Good Vibrations in his head, and then he had to transpose it into music and get the musicians to do what he heard. So he already had that really wide open awareness, and then you add something like LSD into that, you could blow your mind quite literally. And I think he came very close to that. So we're not talking about those kinds of experiences here. We're talking about controlled doses, and microdosing is taking a small amount, about a tenth of the dose, regularly as a way to enhance your creative flow, get you into these states of openness, of productivity, but not in a kind of negative focused way, but actually, let's talk about that. So the left brain would tell you that the more you do, the happier you'll be. And in fact, that's not true. You know, sometimes the productivity curve can really peak and then it goes down because we're so stressed, we can't function. So there is an optimal amount of eustress, if you like, EU stress period, where I think microdosing seems to be bringing me into that. I'm working on so many things at the moment, but I seem to be working efficiently and yet creating time for myself, making sure I have rest and downtime too. So I'm finishing up a book, which will hopefully be out just after Christmas now. I think it's going to be called Microbiome Modification. It's an adaptation, an update of a book I did 7 years ago. But I'll let you know when that comes out. I'm working on that and reading and listening and doing all sorts of things. So it does seem to focus you in a much more congruent way. You can take in more, which is good, but you have to just be aware that it's not just accumulating knowledge, it's about what you do with the knowledge, isn't it? And that's why I'm recording this now. So a good week overall. Yeah, very focused. I guess I would say coherent, following on from the discussion I watched, and feeling like I'm in flow and that my experience matters. I matter. This is why, you know, I do the work I do. It's not an ego-driven statement, that it's saying what I do changes the lives of people so that they can change the lives of other people, so that we can, as a society, get back into a flow state of connection and flow and just make a change in the world that needs to happen. And I would also say the body needs to be much more involved, and women need to be much more involved and step up too, because we do have a different viewpoint. Our brains work differently and are naturally more connected. And if you think that's a sort of feminist statement, it's actually not. It's a neuroscientific fact that the corpus callosum, which unites the left and right brain, is thicker in women. Hence, we multitask better. But also, I think we tend towards the more holistic. So that's kind of why I wanted to do this. And I wanted to do this recording as a middle-aged woman, not as a young guy, kind of talking about, you know, what's hip, what's cool, what's kind of something that I'm doing for reasons of proving myself. I'm doing it really to find out how to live better, how to live more connectedly, and how to change the world. There we go. All right. I hope you found it interesting. Take care of yourselves. More next week, when I'll be probably going through the second hour of the discussion and seeing what comes up from that. I do recommend you watch it, but be aware it's very intellectual, very full of concepts. And if you don't have a background, perhaps in philosophy, you might struggle a little, but it's worth going for it. I certainly enjoyed it. And the transcript is available too, so you can take your time reading it a little bit more. You need to go into the more section of the description. All right. Take care of yourselves. Have a good week, everyone. And I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now. Bye.
Hey, hope you enjoyed listening to Rebel Health Radio. Do subscribe and look forward to catching you soon.